Well, greetings and welcome to the iFormerX podcast, where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care pharmacy practice. This is Stuart Haynes, and I'm the host of the iFormerX podcast. We've known for some time now that systemic inflammation plays a critical role in the development of atherosclerotic vascular disease, and medications like rosuvastatin, which reduce C-reactive protein, a marker of systemic inflammation, reduce the risk of cardiovascular events. Until recently, however, it was unclear if systemic inflammation should be a specific target for treatment, similar to the way that we treat elevated blood cholesterol and blood pressure. 2 years ago, in January 2018, we reviewed the results of the CANTOS study on iFormerX, and the CANTOS study used the monoclonal antibody canakicumab, which is an interleukin-1b inhibitor, to target systemic inflammation. The canakicumab had no effect on blood lipids or blood pressure. It was strictly targeting systemic inflammation. And the results of CANTOS are, I think, pretty compelling, even if canakicumab isn't a very practical treatment choice and was associated with higher infection risk. More recently, the Colcott study, published in December in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think confirms that systemic inflammation is indeed something that we should be treating and targeting for those with atherosclerotic vascular disease. And here today to discuss the results of the Colcott study are Dr. Rob Howe and Dr. Jessica Worden from the West Palm Beach VA Medical Center. Dr. Worden is a PGY2 cardiology pharmacy practice resident, and Dr. Howe is a clinical pharmacy specialist in cardiology and the PGY2 cardiology residency program director. And together they wrote a commentary for iFormerX entitled, "Let's Colcott to the Chase, Colchicine for Secondary Preventions of CV Events." Jessica, it's great to have you on the iFormerX podcast, and Rob, it's great to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Stuart. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So before we get started, I'd like to start with a patient case. I want you to imagine you're seeing JT in the cardiology clinic today. And JT is a 58-year-old African-American male who's a Gulf War veteran who had two cardiac bare metal stents placed 3 weeks ago. And the patient was referred to you to, quote, maximize his treatment regimen. The patient has a strong family history of coronary artery disease, and he previously smoked two packs per day, but eventually quit smoking in 2006. He has a history of high blood cholesterol and dyslipidemia, and he currently takes lisinopril hydrochlorothiazide, metoprolol 50 milligrams daily, the XL product, clopidogrel 75 milligrams daily, aspirin 81 milligrams daily, rosuvastatin 20 milligrams daily, phenofibrate 145 milligrams daily, and he weighs 203 pounds, a BMI of 28.9, so he's overweight. He states that his blood pressure measurements are pretty good, and looking at his logbook, you note that most of his readings are less than 130 over 80. His fasting glucose today was 87, serum creatinine of 0.9 milligrams per deciliter with an estimated GFR greater than 60. LDL cholesterol was 84, HDL of 46, triglycerides of 178. So Rob, before we talk about the study reviewed in your iFormerX commentary, I'm wondering about some of the things that might be going through your mind in this case. What additional information would you want to collect and assess during this encounter? And are there any additional treatment options you'd be considering at this point?
Yeah, so focusing on a case here is something that really kind of captures the double-edged sword of maybe cardiovascular medicine. First off is that we have lots of good evidence to apply. We have lots of good therapies that work. But the challenge often is deciding when to apply certain therapies, when should we intensify things, when should we do things versus just always kind of doing the same thing for every patient. So really captures the notion of treating each patient individually. So a couple of the things that I would want to know really kind of highlight what his actual risk profiles are. So one of the first things that I would want to do with the patient is, first off, congratulate him that he stopped smoking. So we'll talk about things today about reducing risk, but I think a global thing that it's important to emphasize is that any of the interventions we talk about here are all actually outweighed by the possible benefits of smoking cessation. So first off, congratulations to him for doing that at whatever phase he did it. But then to get in specifically to the patient, things that I would want to know is, was the PCI done as a result of an acute coronary syndrome? Did he have a STEMI or end STEMI, or was this an elective stenting that led to that? And while it doesn't necessarily change what we do right now for the patient, it is something that down the line, when we're talking about, especially with dual antiplatelet therapy, or possibly talking about whether or not we're going to intensify lipid therapies or considering colchicine possibly in this instance, knowing the general risk profile and whether this was based on an acute coronary syndrome is going to be an important thing. Also, I'd want to know if the patient has a reduced EF. That really changes the types of therapies that we might consider, whether or not he needs to be considered for something like spironolactone or eplerenone therapy if he also has a reduced ejection fraction. Looking specifically at the patient at this point, his blood pressure looks pretty good. Perhaps if the heart rate's greater than 80 consistently, it might be a reason to push his beta blocker up further. Especially if he also had a reduced EF, then we'd want to push the beta blocker towards his target dose. But one thing that's kind of easy to do is to look at the blood pressure medicines that he's taking. If we think back to the MAPEX study, moving one of the antihypertensive medications to nighttime can significantly reduce his cardiovascular risk down the line. So that's something we want to implement with the patient if he's not already doing so. From a lipid stance, I'd want to know if the rosuvastatin he's on, is that new since he had the stenting? His LDLs, most would consider possibly reasonable, but if this statin's new, then seeing kind of where his LDL goes, but ultimately just the fact that we now have him on a high potency statin is excellent for the patient. Conversely, I'm hard-pressed to find a reason to continue his fibrate at this point. Based on the ACCORD lipid study, we might make the numbers prettier by adding on a fibrate, but we're really not going to reduce his residual cardiovascular risk with that therapy. So given the lack of benefit and an increase in the risk of possible muscle side effects, that's something that I'd like to get the patient off of at this point. And then a couple other things is from a lifestyle standpoint, you mentioned his weight. What's he doing from a weight loss stance? Although not necessarily a pharmacy issue, is he involved in a structured cardiac rehab program post his PCI, especially if he had an ACS or if he also has a reduced EF? Those are things that can definitely improve outcomes down the line. So what's he doing from a lifestyle stance is something that we would want to talk about. And then finally, what's his compliance like with the medications, especially recently after a PCI? We'd want to make sure he has good compliance with his dual antiplatelet therapy. And also then along the lines of med use, kind of what's the patient's view? Within cardiovascular medicine, again, one of the things we have is lots of therapies we can use, but we don't want to also fatigue the patient with an excessive pill burden, excessive treatment burden. So I'd want to know, what does the patient feel? What does the patient want at this point? Does he want to pursue everything we can possibly do? Does he not want to take excessive medications? So to kind of involve him in that mutual decision-making process about what therapies we might consider down the line.
So Jessica, let's talk about the study you critiqued in your iFormerX commentary. The study is entitled Efficacy and Safety of Low-Dose Colchicine After Myocardial Infarction. The study was published, as I mentioned, in the New England Journal of Medicine in December 2019, but it was released online during the American Heart Association's annual meeting in November. We provide a link to that paper on the iFormerX website, but for those in our audience who haven't had a chance to read the paper, can you give us a brief summary of the study design and its major findings?
Absolutely. So prior to Colcott, colchicine was studied as a secondary prevention strategy in patients with stable cardiovascular disease in the LODOCO trial. Although LODOCO found a compelling benefit, the trial was small and thus lacked the ability for broad generalization or application. So the Colcott study built upon this, albeit in a different patient population, specifically in patients following an acute MI. Colcott was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial with patients receiving either colchicine at a dose of 0.5 milligrams daily or placebo. They included patients who had an MI within 30 days prior to enrollment. They had completed any planned percutaneous revascularization procedures and were treated according to national guidelines, which included intensive use of statins, along with dual antiplatelet therapy and beta blockers. They did have an extensive exclusion criteria, but to summarize, it was those with severe heart failure, renal or hepatic disease, weakened immune systems, GI comorbidities such as inflammatory bowel disease or chronic diarrhea, or of course, they were excluded if they had a history of clinically significant sensitivity to colchicine. They looked at the primary efficacy endpoint of the composite of death from cardiovascular causes, resuscitated cardiac arrest, MI, stroke, or urgent hospitalization for angina leading to coronary revascularization, with the secondary endpoints being the components of the primary efficacy endpoint, a composite of death from cardiovascular causes, resuscitated cardiac arrest, MI or stroke, and total mortality. All of these endpoints were analyzed in a time-to-event analysis. Patients began treatment an average of 13 and a half days after the MI, and they were continued on therapy for a median of 22.6 months, so almost 2 years. The primary composite endpoint occurred in 5.5% of patients receiving colchicine and 7.1% of patients receiving placebo, which resulted in a statistically significant hazard ratio of 0.77, which was driven by the endpoints of stroke and urgent hospitalization for angina leading to revascularization. The adverse events were similar between groups, with no difference between groups in diarrhea or GI events. However, there was a statistically significant increase in reported nausea and flatulence in the colchicine group. For serious adverse events, only pneumonia had a statistically significant increase of occurrence in the colchicine group, and there was no difference between groups for the risk of infection or septic shock.
So, Rob, I think most people would consider the Colcott study to be a landmark clinical trial and one we'll probably be talking about for some years to come. But no study is perfect, so I'm wondering what you see are the strengths and weaknesses of the study, and are there any confounders that you think might have impacted the results, and what about the generalizability?
Yeah, so as far as a landmark status, especially you mentioned this was presented at the American Heart Association meeting last year, and really there was a lot of buzz around the trial. That's something possibly I fell into when we were first looking at the trial, but there definitely are some things worth talking about with regards to the design. I think, like you mentioned earlier with the CANTOS trial, this is going to be a landmark study, at least in terms, maybe not clinically, but for the inflammatory hypothesis side of cardiovascular risk reduction. It's another study that confers benefit that doing something to reduce inflammatory processes can also help to reduce cardiovascular risk. Now, with regards to actual its clinical impact, we'll maybe split this up into two items. First off, kind of the design of the trial and then how it was conducted or the outcomes that we actually saw. So from a design stance, it was definitely a positive trial in regards to the fact that they, as Jessica alluded to, did eliminate patients with other inflammatory comorbidities that might have led to a benefit from colchicine therapy. However, from a con stance, this was a post-MI cohort, so may limit some generalizability to the broader range of patients, especially those with stable cardiovascular disease. And also one of the critiques that are probably worth talking about is the endpoint of possible soft endpoint of urgent hospitalization for revascularization. When we think of other landmark studies, if you go back to maybe the CURE study or the heart protection study, the endpoints in those trials were specifically in the CURE study was cardiovascular death, MI, or stroke. Whereas in the heart protection study, actually mortality was the endpoint. So those are real hard, firm endpoints that we're looking at. Now, part of the problem with doing a trial with those endpoints is you have to enroll many more patients because you're looking at less frequent events occurring. So that may not be practical. So that's kind of led investigators to add in this urgent revascularization or urgent hospitalization for angina or unstable angina endpoints. We've seen it in other trials that we look at more recently, including the Odyssey Outcomes study and the Improve It study. So we introduced this idea of really trying to make a decision of whether or not the benefit we're seeing is impactful enough to actually guide practice. So again, as Jessica alluded to, there was a reduction in stroke and there was a reduction in urgent revascularization driving the composite of the primary endpoint. So again, when you look at the top line results of the study and you see a reduction in these events, it's really compelling information, but really when you dive into the nuts and bolts, the actual ultimate clinical benefit may be not as compelling as we first thought it was. However, these are still events that are worth reducing if we can, and we can do it in a safe and effective way. So from as far as how the trial was actually undertaken, as Jessica alluded to, they were on good guideline-directed background therapy. It was done with an intention to treat principle. However, other editorialists and other people talking about the trials have pointed out that there was about a 20% dropout in the study, which may have possibly hid safety issues with the drug or possibly masked some of the potential benefit. However, this 20% dropout was consistent among groups and also maybe better than what we see in actual clinical practice as far as compliance with medications. So ultimately, overall, I think the trial was a very good one. Also, there's some limited generalizability possibly to the U.S. practice in that they did use a 0.5 milligram dose of colchicine, whereas the available dose of colchicine in the U.S. is 0.6 milligrams. Now, for me, clinically, although it's a 20% increase in dose, I'm okay clinically saying that if you have a patient who we're considering using this therapy and then we use the 0.6 milligrams, again, that's based more on my gut than it is actually based on hard facts or outcomes. But I think that's a reasonable thing. However, some people might see that as a limitation.
So Jessica, let's return to the case. Should systemic inflammation be a therapeutic target in a case like JT? And if so, how would you go about measuring systemic inflammation? Or should we just assume that treatments that target systemic inflammation are beneficial and we really don't need to measure the treatment response? And would you actually recommend low-dose colchicine as a treatment approach in this particular patient? And if so, how long would you actually continue colchicine for?
So those are really great questions. From the results of studies looking at other anti-inflammatories, such as canakinumab and methotrexate, it is clear that inhibiting the appropriate anti-inflammatory pathways can lead to cardioprotective effects. In Colcott, they looked at changes in inflammatory markers such as high-sensitivity C-reactive protein and white blood cell count. However, this was an optional exploratory endpoint collected in a small patient population. CRP was collected in a little over 200 patients, and they saw a 10% reduction with colchicine. And in about 2,000 patients, they saw no difference in the white blood cell count between colchicine and placebo. The study was not powered to detect a statistical significance in these changes, and it's really unclear if these changes, such as a 10% reduction in CRP, if it has any real clinical significance. Having shown no correlation with inflammatory markers, there really is no evidence to support a need for inflammatory marker testing when using colchicine for these post-MI patients. And as you said, based off of this evidence, it would be safe to assume that this agent's anti-inflammatory properties are just beneficial. Going back to our patient JT, it is very important to establish his past medical history, as Rob discussed earlier. If he had an MI that led to the revascularization, it would be reasonable to discuss adding colchicine to his therapy. Based off the endpoints that Colcott looked at, if he's having chest pain or maybe he's at a higher risk of stroke, I would be more inclined to start therapy. Additionally, maybe in a younger patient, where you want to be more aggressive with therapy? Additionally, if he has any history suggesting a weakened immune system or a history of inflammatory bowel disease or chronic diarrhea, he wouldn't be a good candidate. When determining treatment duration, it is unclear how long this therapy should be continued for, as colchicine was only studied for a little under 2 years. However, it would be reasonable to continue therapy as long as the patient can tolerate it. This is an issue with the time to event trials. Perhaps after 2 years, if the patient wants to streamline his medications, it would be worth readjusting colchicine therapy at that time.
Well, Rob, Jessica, I want to thank you both for joining me today to discuss the treatment of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and targeting systemic inflammation. I think the results of the Colcott study provide us additional evidence that systemic inflammation is indeed an important therapeutic target, and colchicine is potentially a treatment option that we can use in practice, but there are many unanswered questions, like what patient populations would benefit most, and how long should treatment be continued, and how and when should we measure treatment response? Well, tell us what you think. Remember, only iFormRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormRx. It's free, so sign up today. And to my colleagues who are board-certified ambulatory care pharmacists, I want to make you aware that you can get credit for staying on top of the primary literature. We've partnered with the American Pharmacists Association to offer this program for BCACP recertification credit. So click on the link posted below the commentary on the iFormRx website. And last but not least, a big thank you to all the volunteers who make iFormRx possible. A special shout out to Dr. Nicole Slater at Auburn University, who practices at the South Alabama Family Medicine Clinic in Mobile. Some years ago, Nicole created our very first evidence-based medicine tutorial on numbers needed to treat when she was just a student. Since that time, Nicole ventured off to complete residency training and became an ambulatory care pharmacy specialist. She's written commentaries, reviewed commentaries, and recruited authors. Indeed, she's authoring another commentary that will be posted on iFormerX later this spring. So thank you, Nicole, for being such a great iFormerX contributor all these years. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX, signing off.